Hello and welcome to Volume 46, Number 29 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 17th of July, 2026. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by Alison and Andrew. And in the news this week, the James Paget is to get a new urgent treatment centre, no McDonald's for Caister, and the Argentinians remove the landlord's boxer shorts. All this, plus Grapevine Extra with Andrew and Alison on the heatwave. Well, after last week's bumper bundle of birthdays, we've none at all this week, so it's straight over to Andrew and Alison with the first of this week's local news.
Hello, everyone. The James Paget University Hospital in Galston is planning to build a new urgent treatment centre. The hospital has submitted two planning applications to Great Yarmouth Borough Council as it pushes ahead with a major overhaul of its urgent and emergency care services. The Trust has lodged a full planning application for a new Urgent Treatment Centre, or UTC. The single-storey, 550-square-metre building would sit to the northeast of the main hospital building and handle minor injuries and illnesses, the kinds of cases that do not need the full resources of A&D. A covered walkway would link it to an extended emergency department entrance lobby, creating a single front door where patients are streamed on arrival into the right pathway. Alongside that, the hospital has applied for a lawful development certificate for a smaller GP streaming unit, a 180-square-metre building to the south of the main block, where non-emergency patients would be assessed and treated by GPs. The Trust argues the unit can be built under permitted development rights without requiring full planning consent. The Paget is one of seven NHS hospitals across England built using reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, or RAC, a material now considered a structural risk, and has been prioritised for a complete rebuild under the government's new hospital programme. A hybrid planning application for the new hospital, which would have approximately 600 inpatient beds, was submitted to the Borough Council late last year. Construction is expected to begin in 2027-28, with the new hospital targeting an opening date of 2032-33. The Trust says the new UTC has been specifically designed to be compatible with those longer-term plans.
A replica of the first ship to circumnavigate the world is coming to the town. The Neo Victoria, a life-size replica of the first ship to travel around the globe, will be docked in Great Yarmouth from July the 29th to August the 9th. Open to the public throughout its stay, the ship offers a rare opportunity to step aboard a living piece of maritime history. During her time on the Norfolk coast, visitors will be able to see a recreation of conditions aboard, as well as a host of other features, exhibits and displays. Group visits can be arranged, as well as receptions and corporate events. James Bensley of the Great Yarmouth Borough Council Portfolio for Tourism, Culture and Coastal Management said, "We're delighted to have helped secure the visit of the Neo Victoria to the town this summer. The unique vessel promises to offer a fascinating day out for people of all ages. She is truly an incredible ship and we can't wait for her arrival." Built in Spain in 1991, the replica is modelled on the original 16th century vessel commanded by Juan Sebastian Elcano, who completed the world voyage between 1519 and 1522. And the replica takes part in major international events as well as being a floating museum and training ship. In the past decade, she has sailed thousands of miles, visiting ports across the world, welcoming more than 6 million visitors aboard. Its visit follows the previous tall ship stopovers in Great Yarmouth, including the Neo Santa Maria in 2023, and the galleon Andalusia earlier in 2024. Jonathan Newman of the Great Yarmouth Town Centre Partnership said, "We hope the opportunity to explore this unique tall ship will provide an extra incentive for families to visit the town and its historic South Quay." The ship will be open daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. with an opening ceremony scheduled for July the 29th.
The Britannia Pier is planning to open a new beer garden as part of a major £2.2 million revamp. The pier's owners have applied for planning permission to build an external raised decking area and change the use of land north of Pier Tavern to use as a new beer garden. It is the latest stage in the massive transformation taking place on the pier that has already seen its owners open a new indoor entertainment centre and sports bar. The proposed decking would extend straight from the Pier Tavern and run alongside most of the width of the bar. The plans will be discussed at a meeting of Great Yarmouth Borough Council's Development Management Committee on Wednesday, July the 22nd. In a document published ahead of the meeting, planners said the introduction of a beer garden and decking area is likely to increase the level of noise emitted from that part of the pier when it's in use. They said the use would be more appropriately controlled via the licensing process to restrict the hours that it can be used. The area would also benefit from a CCTV and a lighting scheme to tackle antisocial behaviour, they said. Officials are recommending that councillors approve the plans. The pier, which was named the National Pier Society's Pier of the Year 2026, opened its new look Pier Tavern in April. It was the latest stage to be completed in the owner's grand project for the pier, which began in November 2024. Last year, the pier officially opened its new indoor entertainment centre and trebled the size of the arcade. An 8 metre wide and 3 metre high digital advertising screen was also installed at the front of the pier to help illuminate the building at night. They also added new rides at the end of the pier theme park and installed more traditional lighting along the deck. The original Britannia Pier opened on July the 13th, 1858, and was about 700 feet long. It was shortened by about 80 feet after a ship collided with it during the Royal Charter storm in 1859. It suffered further storm damage in 1868 and was demolished in 1899. Construction of a new 810-foot Britannia Pier began in December 1900 to the designs of engineers Joseph and Arthur Mayo. Many changes took place at the pier following a series of fires in 1909, 1914, 1932 and 1954. The current pavilion, now housing the theatre, opened on June 27, 1958. Since acquiring the pier in December 2022, the current owners, Triangle Amusements Limited, have added new rides to the theme park at the end of the pier, revamped the arcades and installed traditional lighting along the deck.
Now, this story, we're staying with a pub theme, and I might have been reading it to you in such a different way if a certain Mr. Martinez hadn't popped up in the 92nd minute and scored a goal the other night. This concerns a Norfolk pub landlord who has vowed to serve behind a bar wearing nothing but a pair of St George's flag boxer shorts, but only if England win the World Cup. Well, we all know how that's going at the moment. Anyway, this was the confident pledge of the Gate pub at Caister, the landlord Harry Ames, ahead of England's World Cup semi-final showdown against Argentina. The pub had been drawing in crowds of around 200 people for every England game, and he's been overwhelmed by the support of the community during the tournament. Mr. Ames said, "It's just been amazing. We've been fully booked for every game. It's been an incredible atmosphere, the singing and the chanting. It has been safe and good fun. This tournament, I wanted to focus on giving the people of Caister a brilliant experience and atmosphere for the community. Fans have been packing into the pub to watch England's progress on a giant 120-inch screen that he had installed to go alongside the 7 TVs already in the pub. And locals have come out in force to support the nation's World Cup journey, including the 2 a.m. kickoff for the last 16 game against Mexico." Harry said, "Creating a community pub for Caister for the World Cup, that's been our biggest success. I've never seen England play at that time before, and England fans coming in at 9 or 10 p.m. for a 2 a.m. kickoff. We finished at 4:45 in the morning. It was really strange, really surreal." The pub has seen a surge in popularity online and gaining more than 400 new Facebook followers since the tournament began. And it's hosted pre-match garden parties with DJ Shoreline Sounds to help build the atmosphere. And he has, or should I say had, even bigger plans if England were to progress to the showpiece final. At the time, Harry said, if we're lucky to get to the final, we're talking about more DJs, photographers and confetti cannons. We're really going to go for it. And the idea to serve pints in his boxes all comes back to one famous television stunt involving a former England star and Match of the Day presenter. Harry said, my brother Jack is a Leicester City fan. And he said to me, do you remember when Gary Lineker said that if Leicester won the league, he'd present Match of the Day in his boxer shorts? Well, I'd promised everyone that if England win the World Cup, I'll wear St George's flag boxers behind the bar. I want to give something back, and it's all in the name of good fun. Well, Harry, well done. It's just a shame it didn't all work out the way we hoped it would. But we'll stay just on a football theme now, and football fans were able to enjoy England's World Cup match on Wednesday on a giant 60-metre square screen at Great Yarmouth Racecourse. The World Cup semi-final against Argentina was shown live after the venue's ladies' evening. Before the day, a spokeswoman for Great Yarmouth Racecourse said, join us on Wednesday the 15th of July for an unforgettable ladies' evening at Great Yarmouth Racecourse. Already a summer highlight, and now with the biggest football party on the East Coast. Gates opened at 3:30 with the first race at 5 and the final race at 7:40. Football ticket holders entered from 6:30, which was time to catch the last two races before the 8 p.m. kickoff. Tickets cost £10 and included a welcome drink. England supporters were encouraged to swap their race day attire for England shirts as the atmosphere built before kickoff. And drinks were available throughout the evening, with pints from £5 and £10 off bottles of Prosecco. Well, great effort, everybody. As I say, shame it didn't end that way, but we try again.
And we haven't finished with the World Cup yet. A circus show was cancelled, so its English and Argentinian performers could watch the World Cup semi-final. The Hippodrome's summer spectacular, Pulse, was cancelled to allow cast, crew and audience to watch the match on Wednesday night, July the 15th. The cast includes a mix of English and Argentinian performers, with the cancellation allowing both sides to watch what could have become a historic result. Jack Jay, producer and co-host of the show, said before the day, we always pride ourselves on bringing together the world's greatest performers, but we didn't expect to bring the World Cup drama right into our backyard. With such a huge match ahead, we knew we had to make a bold call. We want our audiences to be able to watch the game and not lose their tickets bought in advance, plus our English cast and crew to cheer on the Three Lions. And honestly, we want our Argentinian stars to enjoy the beautiful game too, even if they'll be wearing different shirts. The Hippodrome team thanked ticket holders for their understanding and support. The team said, audience members affected by the cancellation were amazingly accommodating. Thanks to their support, we were able to seamlessly move everyone into other performances throughout our summer run, with others receiving ticket vouchers for future show dates. The pulse-pounding action of Pulse resumed on Thursday, the 16th of July. The Hippodrome's summer run continues daily until September the 13th. The circus is known for its trademark sinking ring water spectacular, high adrenaline acrobatics, and the comedy duo of Jack Jay and Johnny Mack. Tickets are available via the box office or online at hippodromecircus, that's all one word, .co.uk. The Hippodrome team also wished England the best of luck ahead of the semi-final.
It's a Broads village known for its historic and tranquil duck ponds. But concerns have been raised in Martham about the condition of one of its best-known water features. A parishioner has reported issues at the pond on the village green opposite the King's Arms pub, including litter, algae, dead wildlife and deteriorating banks. Martham Parish Council has acknowledged the problem and said they're committed to developing an action plan. Parish Clerk Stacey Kent blamed the condition of the pond on the recent poor weather. It needs to be dredged by a professional, but it needs an engineer from Norfolk County Council to look at the sides before we start, she said, and added that the Parish Council is working on an action plan with other agencies. Algae blooms have been particularly severe across the UK this year after a warmer than average spring, combined with low water levels and high nutrient levels. The matter has also been reported to Rupert Lowe, MP for Great Yarmouth. He said, I'm pleased to say that our councillor Jason Hughes is on the case. A small effort to keep it clean and the whole village will benefit. Let's make it happen. Martham is known for its two historic duck ponds, one of which dates back more than a century and was painted by artist William Gilbert Foster around 1890. Its twin pond was on Cranes Green, just in front of the Co-op. Shortly before the Co-op was built in 1936, that pond vanished, possibly drying up as better roads and sewers reduced the runoff that had fed the pond. The main village pond has also been the site of two drownings. In 1942, a man died after falling in during the wartime blackout. 6 months later, another man drowned in similar circumstances. And those tragedies prompted the parish council to install railings around the pond. The village has several other ponds, including the one at the opposite end of the green, known locally as the Chip Shop Pond. You see, we bring you everything here on Grapevine.
The night sky over a Norfolk seafront will light up in dramatic technicolour as a pyrotechnic plane returns with airborne fireworks and aerobatic displays. The dazzling firework nights, Big Wednesdays at Great Yarmouth and Big Tuesdays at Hemsby, are returning next week for six summer spectaculars. And this year we'll see the return of AeroSparks' motor glider, lit by 2,000 LED lights, which wowed crowds with its choreographed pyrotechnic displays over the sea, while igniting fireworks from its wings. It's the only team in the world to combine formation flying, aerobatics and nighttime pyrotechnics, and has thrilled crowds at the Dubai World Cup and the Formula One in Saudi Arabia. Rob Barsby, AeroSparks pilot, promised bigger and better this year and said, "We don't do many shows in the UK, so that makes Great Yarmouth special. We have flown all over the world since last year, and I've been contacted by people on social media who saw us in Great Yarmouth last year, saying they will be back this year." Nathan Race, chairman of Visit Great Yarmouth, said, "We cannot wait for this year's Big Tuesdays and Big Wednesdays to start. They have become highlights of the annual calendar. Residents and visitors alike plan their trips and holidays around the dates, travelling from far and wide to enjoy the incredible displays and everything our seafront has to offer." The economic impact of last year's events was valued at £3.3 million, supporting 45 full-time equivalent jobs. For every pound spent on the fireworks, £22 was generated for the local economy. Asa Morrison, chief executive of Visit Great Yarmouth, said, "The new dimension of the spectacular pyrotechnic plane displays was a real hit last year. So we're building on that for this summer with AeroSparks, as we also maximise our displays from the beach. The pyrotechnic plane will take to the skies at around 9 p.m, followed by the main fireworks at 10 p.m.
And staying with entertainment, the all-new summer show has arrived at the Galston Pavilion, and it is already capturing the full attention of audiences with its unwavering energy. From Zumba to a Queen medley and Houdini-style magic tricks, this summer show has everything you could imagine. Directed by Joe Ringer, this seasonal production marks the 125th anniversary of the Seafront Theatre and, I'm quoting here from the Yarmouth Mercury critic, "From the moment it started, I was impressed." It's a variety show in every sense as it leaps between different decades of music, magic tricks and comedy, which were woven together seamlessly throughout. And even though you cannot predict what is about to come next, it maintains a clear structure, making it easy to follow. It has an impressive cast of only 8 performers, including Eddie Bushell, Joshua Pickering, Ben Carruthers, Nina Taylor and Craig Catchpole. They never fail to entertain the audience not only with their humour, but with their incredible theatrical talent too. And one element which you could not miss was how much fun they seemed to have on stage, which was infectious to all watching. The intimate setting of the pavilion also played a major role in how the show came across. Seated around low tables close to the performers, the line between audience and cast dissolves almost completely, and in some moments vanishes entirely. One highlight of the show was when the cast encouraged us to get on our feet for a crash course in line dancing to the 90s hit Achy Breaky Heart. As we stumbled and laughed through it, we became part of the show, making a special moment of the night. And a comedy was clearly written with locals in mind. Jokes about the Achill Strait and Cromer raised knowing laughs from the room. And even though a few lines felt familiar, they were delivered in a way which didn't fail to make you laugh. So, if you want to watch a show bursting with energy, joy and talent, this is one not to miss. And the all-new summer show is running at the Galston Pavilion until September the 10th.
A telecoms company is fighting the council's decision to refuse plans for communication kiosks in the town centre. New World Payphones, or NWP Street Limited, based in London, lodged an appeal with the Planning Inspectorate after Great Yarmouth Borough Council refused three separate applications to install multifunctional kiosks at North Quay, Marketplace and Regent Road in Great Yarmouth. The company had proposed replacing outdated phone boxes with open-plan steel units offering free calls to emergency services and charities, including Samaritans and Childline. The kiosks would also have had interactive touchscreen wayfinding, digital advertising displays and publicly accessible defibrillators registered on the National Emergency Network. The council refused the applications, noting the bulky appearance of the kiosks. In their final appeal, NWP says the council failed to give proper weight to the defibrillator, which the company says could prove critical, given that more than 30,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests occur in the UK each year. The firm also contests the bulky label, pointing out the kiosk has a footprint of 0.41 square metres, smaller than most bus shelters or advertising hoardings.
A row has broken out over plans to fell a row of trees in Scrappy. The saga has seen neighbours accusing a homeowner's survey of being biased and pointing out a conflicting report commissioned by council planners. John Crytoff of Abel's Court on Beach Road in Scrappy has applied to Great Yarmouth Borough Council to fell 6 of 17 Lombardy poplars protected under a tree preservation order, after one tree collapsed onto his home, causing significant roofing damage. A survey by arboricultural consultant Ian Flatters of Target Trees found the trees to be in serious decline, with 10 given a life expectancy of under 10 years. The report blames construction activity on two adjacent development sites, including Badger Building's Orchard Meadow scheme, for accelerating the damage, stating that fence posts had been concreted directly into the tree's root areas with no protective sheathing. The report calls on the Borough Council to investigate whether planning breaches have occurred at either site. But five residents of neighbouring Woodlands Close have objected. One questioned whether the report was genuinely independent, noting that Mr Flatters both authorised the survey and submitted the application. Another objector claimed the report, quote, seemed vastly at odds with the arborist report commissioned by the Borough Council in September 2025. Neighbours also point out that the trees were a feature of the area long before the new built homes at Abel's Court were constructed. These trees are very much a landmark for Scrappy, one said. The trees were there well before the new build bungalows, so if anyone had an issue with them, maybe they should have reconsidered buying so close to the trees. Neighbours also note that this is at least the third attempt to carry out works on the trees in 3 years, with an application for their total removal refused in 2024. It would be a sad day for Scrappy if these trees were felled, one villager said. The application was discussed at a meeting of Ormsby St Margaret with Scrappy Parish Council on Monday, July the 13th.
Free beach wheelchairs are now available on Sea Pauling Beach for people with mobility issues. The scheme was launched by Sea Pauling and Waxham Parish Council and aims to tackle the barrier wheelchair users face to get beyond the promenade. People who have previously had to wait at the ramp or cafe are now able to reach the sand and the sea. Sue Hutchins from Hoveton used the new wheelchair. She said, "We all used to come here as a family and I've missed doing that. Being able to do that again is absolutely great. It's a lovely feeling. I'm just part of the family again." The parish council received positive feedback from a family who used the new chairs. A terminally ill woman was able to revisit Sea Pauling for what may be the final time, spending the afternoon on the beach collecting pebbles, eating fish and chips and enjoying the coastline she had loved since childhood. Two chairs are currently available, including an adult model and a smaller version suitable for children, and can be booked online or at Sandy Hills Snack Bar. The project was funded through local and national support, with 80% provided by the Farming and Protected Landscapes Programme, and the remaining 20% covered by the Parish Council. Bookings run daily from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m, with collection from Sandy Hills. Cromer and Sheringham had beach wheelchairs introduced in 2021. Sea Pauling Beach holds a blue flag status.
A church's impact in changing lives has been valued in millions of pounds by a report. St Mary Magdalene Church in Galston delivers more than 2.5 million in annual social value, according to a study by the National Churches Trust. The figure was calculated using HM Treasury's approved wellbeing methodology and places a value of £2,504,445 on the church's activities. This includes support for families, reducing loneliness and helping vulnerable people. Reverend Matthew Price, the vicar of St Mary Magdalene, said, "We know that churches make a difference because we see lives being changed every week. What is exciting about this report is that it puts independent evidence behind what so many people experience firsthand. The £2.5 million figure isn't about putting a price on kindness or compassion. It's about helping people recognise that when local churches support families, tackle loneliness, care for young people and provide practical help, it creates real value for the whole community," he said. The church is home to the Galston Food Bank, youth programmes, bereavement support and activities for families and older people. Other initiatives include volunteering opportunities and community groups. The report estimates that around 450 households are supported by the food bank, while 180 people attend monthly community groups. Youth activities reach 30 young people, with a further 20 people receiving bereavement support. And the church also relies on around 80 regular volunteers. Reverend Price said, "Every cup of tea served, every volunteer who gives their time, every conversation, every food parcel and every young person welcomed matters. And this report celebrates the incredible generosity of hundreds of volunteers, partners and community organisations who make that possible." What a positive story that is.
Well, news in brief coming up in a short while, plus more full-fat news. First, though, details of an event which will celebrate the 220th anniversary of Vision Norfolk. On Sunday, the 26th of July, it's the 220th anniversary summer garden party at Bishop's Gardens, Norwich, from 1 p.m. until 4:30 p.m. This will be a fun-filled outdoor event where you can enjoy music, food and great company. Take in the beautiful surroundings of the Bishop's Garden while supporting Norfolk's local sight loss charity. This is a perfect opportunity to relax and unwind in a picturesque setting. Whether you're a long-term supporter or new to Vision Norfolk, this event is open to all. Don't miss out on this summer celebration, which will feature live music from Tats Buskers, a tombola, refreshments for sale including non-alcoholic Pimm's, a children's treasure hunt and family activities, Bokia on the lawn. Staff will be available to answer any questions about Vision Norfolk, and of course there's much, much more. Tickets are £5, although under-16s and wheelchair users go free. The tickets can be purchased online or bought on the day at the gate, unless of course they sell out. Online ticket sales will close on midday on Friday the 24th of July. Now, this is a long address. The online tickets can be bought at visionnorfolk-bishopsgarden-220summergardenparty.eventbrite.com. So that's Vision Norfolk, all one word, hyphen Bishop's Garden, all one word, hyphen 220 Summer Garden Party, all one word, .eventbrite.com. And 220 is are the numbers 2, 2 and 0. Vision Norfolk, Bishopsgarden, 220 Summer Garden Party, .eventbrite.com. OK, it's time for some news in brief.
The son of legendary magician Paul Daniels is set to perform in Galston. Martin Daniels, known for his sharp wit and magic skills, will be performing at Galston Pavilion Theatre on Friday, August the 7th at 7:30. He'll be joined by a special musical guest, Britain's Got Talent finalist Sarah Jameson. Daniels, who often appeared on his father's TV show, has also presented Game for a Laugh and Lingo and appeared on Les Dennis's Laughter Show. He's performed 5 times on the Children's Royal Variety Show and is a member of the Magic Circle. Tickets are available for £20 and can be booked via the Galston Pavilion website or by calling the box office on 01493 622 832. That's 01493 622 832. Police are asking for help to find a missing woman. Rachel Fitzgerald, aged 40, was last seen on Monday, June the 22nd, and was reported missing on Monday, July the 13th. She is white, 5 feet 9 tall, has a slim build and shoulder-length hair that is a mix of red, blonde and brown. She has connections in Norwich, Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft. A large search and rescue operation was launched off the coast on Monday. An HM Coast Guard helicopter operated by Bristow Helicopters was seen performing search patterns between California, Caistron Sea and Great Yarmouth after a person was reported in the sea just off Scrappy. The person had reportedly gone into the sea at around 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. Caistor Independent lifeboats were launched at 8 p.m. to assist with the search, and a Great Yarmouth and Galston R&L lifeboat was also launched. The search for the person continued until 3 a.m. that morning before it was called off by the Coast Guards. Great Yarmouth Swimming Club's Learn to Swim programme and the Royal National Lifeboat Institution have collaborated for Drowning Prevention Week. The RNLI Beach Lifeguards explained water safety to children, and their safety initiative comes with the hot weather bringing reports, tragically, of drownings across the country. The collaboration highlighted the fact that water safety goes far beyond just swimming ability and that these lessons cannot be learned too young. Further details about water safety are available on the RNLI and the swimming club's websites.
A trio have been arrested after being caught attempting to break into garages in Galston. The group were caught in Somerville Avenue, Galston, at 10:09 p.m. on July the 8th. Police attended the scene and 3 people were stopped in a vehicle and arrested on suspicion of burglary non-dwelling. A man in his 30s, a woman in her 40s and a man in his 20s were taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning. The man in his 30s and the woman in her 40s have since been bailed until August the 21st and the man in his 20s until August the 14th. A spokesman for the force said inquiries continue. A garden centre cafe, which opened last month, is seeking permission to sell alcohol. Sarah Jane Lawson, who runs Scrappy Garden Centre on Beach Road in Scrappy, has applied to Great Yarmouth Borough Council for a new licence. If approved, it would allow her to sell alcohol at the premises every day from 7 a.m. until midnight. The application includes both on and off sales. An art gallery in Great Yarmouth has applied to sell alcohol and host live music events. Moira Huggins of South Quay Gallery has submitted an application to Great Yarmouth Borough Council for a new licence. This would allow the venue to play films, live music, recorded music and dance from Wednesday to Sunday from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. It would also permit the sale of alcohol on the same days from 12 p.m. to 11 p.m. A major supermarket is making another attempt to open a store in Galston. Lidl is drawing up plans to build on undeveloped land 2 years after a scheme in Lynx Road was abandoned. The chain is hoping a move, approximately half a mile up the road to Beacon Park, will mean it can finally open in the town. Initial details sent to Great Yarmouth Borough Council suggest the store could be built off Beaufort Way and Hods Lane.
Okay, it's time to get you completely up to date with the rest of this week's local news, followed by Grapevine Extra.
The identity of a man who drowned at sea despite a major rescue mission has been revealed. Caister Lifeboat first received reports of a man overboard in the waters near Hemsby on Tuesday, June the 30th, shortly before 5 p.m. A crew member from the Star of Faith, which works as a guard vessel for offshore projects like wind farms and subsea cables, had been reported missing from the boat. At 5:11 p.m, Lifeboat arrived at the scene and shortly after launching the crew received a second page requesting the launch of its inshore lifeboat, or ILB, to assist with the search. Around 30 minutes later, Humber Coast Guard directed the all-weather vessel to carry out a parallel line search pattern while the ILB searched back along the route of the Star of Faith towards Great Yarmouth. At 6:21 p.m, Coast Guard Rescue Helicopter 912 found the man in the water and directed the lifeboat to his location by dropping an orange flare, after which he was pulled from the water and immediately given CPR. A medic from the helicopter was lowered onto the lifeboat to assist with emergency care, but despite the crew's best efforts, the man could not be saved. Caister Lifeboat arrived back at its station just before 6:50 p.m, where they were met by police, ambulance crews and local Coast Guard rescue teams. A number of search assets were involved in the rescue. An inquest into the man's death was opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court on Wednesday, July the 15th, where the man was named as Michael Clark. The court heard the 62-year-old's provisional cause of death was by drowning in an RNLI Coast Guard boat off the coast of Caister near Yarmouth. Area coroner Joanna Thompson revealed Mr. Clark worked as a seaman and lived in the coastal Lincolnshire town of Cleethorpes. She also confirmed he had been born in Grimsby, Lincolnshire, on February the 17th, 1964. A full inquest into his death will take place at the court on November the 4th at 11:30 a.m. to examine the full circumstances of what happened. Following the tragedy, a spokesman for Caister Lifeboat said, "Our thoughts are with the casualties' family, friends and all those affected by this tragic incident."
A bitter feud between two rival barbers ended up with one attacking the other with a metal dumbbell outside his barbershop. Ashley Parsons, aged 44, assaulted 29-year-old Bradley Pruden by smashing his van windscreen outside Brad's Barbers in Martham. A court heard Parsons, who owns Gentleman Jack's barbershops in Acle and Rollsby, launched the violent attack after driving to the hairdresser's in his Mercedes. Lilica Pethera, prosecuting, said, "The complainant walks back to his business van and gets into his van. The defendant pulls up in his Mercedes. The defendant then pulled out a foot-long metal pole, smashed the van windows and showered the victim in smashed glass. The victim took the opportunity to flee the van and the defendant chased him and shouted that he will kill him." The court was told Parsons had a long-running feud with Mr. Pruden, with the two involved in a propaganda war on social media over each other's businesses. Parsons, who is up for a national award as Best Barber in the 2026 UK Hair and Beauty Awards, snapped after Mr. Pruden alleged he was having an affair, arriving at the barbershop before 11 a.m. After chasing Pruden down the road, he returned to his Mercedes and fled the scene, before handing himself into Great Yarmouth Police Station, where he was arrested on March the 13th. Richard Mann, mitigating, said, "There is clearly bad blood and clearly no love lost between them. This is a man who doesn't ordinarily snap. He has been poked and poked and poked, and eventually he has reacted. He said he suffered endless provocation of a very long and sustained period of time in relation to his business that led to allegations that he was having an affair, which he denied. It was at that point he snapped." Appearing at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court, Parsons of the Street in Acle pleaded guilty to assault by beating, using threatening behaviour and possessing an offensive weapon in a public place. He was handed an 18-month community order, must pay a £500 fine, prosecution costs of £85 and compensation of £144 to Mr. Pruden. Parsons must not contact Pruden and his partner, or go to the Green in Martham, or contact members of Pruden's barber staff under the restraining orders imposed.
A bid to build a McDonald's restaurant at the edge of Caister Village has been rejected by officials, who said it would spoil the surrounding countryside. Officers from Great Yarmouth Borough Council have blocked the application for the new site at Caister, meaning it will not even be considered by councillors at planning meeting. Developers had wanted to build the fast food outlet, along with a petrol station and drive-through coffee shop, at the junction of Yarmouth Road and the Caister Bypass. As well as raising concerns about the impact on the countryside, officials also said the businesses could create an accident black spot. They said cars would enter the site at high speeds, putting pedestrians making their way to the restaurant on foot at risk of being hit. The site is near to Yarmouth Stadium and Tesco and is on the edge of the heavily developed village. However, officers said the introduction of a sprawling commercial service area, expansive hard standing, illuminated signage and associated infrastructure into this edge of settlement location fails to respect the intrinsic character and beauty of the countryside. The officials added if the development was backed, it would have obliterated the existing openness of the site. In addition, the officers said the scheme would bring a town centre feel to the Norfolk countryside. Objections from locals included fear it would take away trade from Caister Village. The proposed site is around a mile from Caister High Street. Another local said the local road network is already at breaking point, particularly during race days and events at Yarmouth Stadium, where vehicles park along grass verges, pavements and cycle paths. There was just one supporter of the scheme who said the development would have created jobs for the area. Approximately 165 posts would have been created had the plans come to fruition. No firm had been lined up to take over the drive-through coffee shop, according to documents for the project.
Tributes have been paid to a very special young lady following her death. Bobby Lee Burlingham, aged 16, died at James Paget Hospital in Galston on July the 2nd. An inquest into her death was opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court a week later. It gave provisional cause of death as multi-organ failure due to dysautonomia, due to cerebral palsy, due to hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy at birth. Family, friends and those who knew Miss Burlingham paid tribute to her via an online memorial page. Karen Durrant said, "You will be very much missed, Bobby Lee. You were a very special young lady." Debbie Scarlett added, "Fly high among the stars, little lady. You will never be forgotten." And the page is raising money for the James Paget Hospital charity. The court heard that Miss Burlingham was born on July the 29th, 2009 in Galston and lived at Court and Long Lane in Lowestoft. Area Coroner Yvonne Blake adjourned the inquest to take place at 3 p.m. on July the 24th.
An investigation has been opened into the death of a Galston man. Ross Andrew Jones, aged 34, was found dead at Marsh Farm caravan site, Mill Road, Great Yarmouth, on May the 4th, 2026. Area coroner Maeve Sykes was told that Mr. Jones died from diabetic ketoacidosis, complicated by drug use. A post-mortem examination by Dr. Ray Lonsdale concluded that the provisional cause of death was diabetic ketoacidosis due to uncontrolled diabetes mellitus, with cocaine and ketamine use recorded as contributing factors. Mr. Jones was identified at the scene by his neighbour, Martin Holden. His brother, Daniel Jones, confirmed he had been born in Galston on March the 4th, 1992. No family members were present at the hearing. The coroner invited Mr. Jones's family to provide a pen portrait describing his life and to raise any concerns they wished the court to consider that may be relevant to the circumstances of his death. The inquest was adjourned until 3 p.m. on October the 20th, 2026.
A 27-metre vessel that was taking on water off the Suffolk coast sparked a major emergency response following a Mayday call for help. Lowestoft RNI lifeboat responded on its second call out of the day after the three-man crew discovered water coming into one of the craft's two hulls. The crew transfer vessel, with three people aboard, was working on the East Anglia 3 wind farm when it called for help at 2:09 p.m. on Tuesday, July the 14th. Lowestoft lifeboat responded to assist the crew transfer vessel, which was taking on water 43 miles northeast of the Suffolk coast. Lowestoft lifeboat coxswain John Fox said, "The crew transfer vessel was working on the East Anglia Three wind farm when they discovered the emergency and called for help. The vessel was limping back to the coast at 10 knots, using one engine, and we reached them when they were about 25 miles away. An HM Coast Guard helicopter had also arrived at the scene and was ready to take two crewmen off the vessel, but this was eventually found not to be necessary." Mr. Fox added, "A sister wind farm vessel that was nearby had brought an extra pump to help with the incoming seawater, but the ship's crew gratefully accepted our offer of the use of the RNLI portable pump as well. We moved alongside and our volunteer crew transferred our pump and hoses across together, along with a member of the lifeboat crew, to operate it. The seawater appeared to be coming in from around the engine shaft, and the crew made efforts to stem the leak, but with limited success. The three pumps being used managed to keep the water level down as the captain arranged to head for the Alleycat workboat's boatyard in Great Yarmouth, where the vessel would be lifted from the water." Mr. Fox added, "We escorted the boat to the boatyard where our colleagues from Great Yarmouth and Goulston RNLI launched their lifeboat and used their portable pump to take over from us. And we returned to Lowestoft, arriving back on our mooring at 9:15 p.m. after a 7-hour call-out." Wow.
A tribute show to Neil Diamond is set to take place in Great Yarmouth. Song Sung Blue, the music of Neil Diamond, will be performed at the Britannia Pier Theatre on Sunday, August the 9th at 7:30 p.m. The show will commemorate 60 years since Neil Diamond's first hit single. With over 130 million records sold, Mr. Diamond's music continues to be celebrated by fans across the world. The performance will feature many of his classic hits, including Sweet Caroline, Cracklin' Rosie, I'm a Believer, I Am, I Said, Forever in Blue Jeans, Love on the Rocks, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, Song Sung Blue, and Red Red Wine. The show will be performed by a live band and backing singers, aiming to capture Mr. Diamond's unique sound. Stephen, with more than 20 years of professional stage experience, will front the production. The show has been described as a love letter to the music of Neil Diamond, showcasing songs from the 1960s, 70s and 80s. Tickets, priced at £28.50 plus a booking fee, are available on the Britannia Pier website.
Interesting story about Neil Diamond. A good few years ago, and he'd been busy writing, dashed out to his local delicatessen in New York, picked up three things, took them to the counter, and the guy who owned a delicatessen knew Neil quite well. He said, "How's it going then, Neil?" He said, yeah, really good. He said, "I've just written this new song." He said, "Absolutely stuck for a title." He said, I don't know what to call it. So he said, "I really can't stop and chat today, Louis. I need to get back to the studio." So Louis, behind the counter, just picked up the three items, went, "OK, Neil, so that's Swede, Carrot, Lime." Neil picked them up, put them in a bag, and as he walked out the door, he said, "That's it. That's going to be the title."
Wow. Remarkable.
Is it me?
Yes.
Rising costs are making it harder for parents to support their children's football dreams. But in Hopton, young players and their families have been given a boost after a village team won new football kits through Iceland Foods' nationwide Kits for Kids competition. Hopton Harriers has new kits for its Stingrays under-8s team. The Kits for Kids scheme was launched in response to research showing that 86% of parents feel the financial squeeze is making it difficult to support their children's involvement in football. For many grassroots clubs, the rising cost of kits means they depend on fundraising and community support to cover basic equipment. Rob Fawcett, chairman of Hopton Harriers FC, said, "The Harriers is a core part of our village, making a huge impact on the lives of local children and their families, as well as the wider community. We're one big family club, aiming to build confidence and self-belief with our player-centred approach. Winning the Kits for Kids competition has been fantastic for us in providing some much-needed new kits for our teams and a real boost as they continue to grow and develop. The club supports children aged from 2 to 16 and runs two disability teams alongside pan-disability sessions. The Harriers is run by a dedicated team of volunteers and coaches, two of whom are planning a skydive in July to raise funds for the club." Lee Cushing, store manager at Iceland in Goulston, said, Grassroots clubs like Hopton Harriers play such an important role in their communities, but we know many struggle to raise funds for essentials like kits. It's been a privilege to meet the players and see firsthand the impact these new strips have had. The Kits for Kids initiative is helping young players across the UK play football with confidence.
A man who doted on his mum turned to drug dealing to help her after she ran up debts by becoming addicted to cocaine following the death of her father, a court has heard. Harley Dos Santos became involved in supplying cocaine to help Nicola Pollard pay off debts she had accrued through her drug addiction. Norwich Crown Court heard the 21-year-old aroused the suspicion of police after officers spotted him leaving and entering alleyways in Blackfriars Road, Great Yarmouth. Richard White, prosecuting, said police found him with three wraps of cocaine. Dos Santos was arrested but called out to his mother, who was at a nearby address. During the search of their home, police found further wraps and cash in Dos Santos' bedroom. Police also searched Pollard's room and found a total of 215 grams of cocaine. Dos Santos and Pollard, both formerly of Camden Road, Yarmouth, appeared at court on Tuesday, July the 14th, after both previously admitted possession with intent to supply cocaine on February the 9th this year. The court was told Pollard had become addicted to cocaine following the death of her father and was supplying drugs to pay back a debt she had run up. The prosecutor said Dos Santos had been involved in dealing to help his mother pay off her debts. Oliver Haswell for Dos Santos, who now lives in Galston, said he had no previous convictions and was a sad victim of circumstance, having only got involved in drug dealing to protect his mum. Ian James, for Pollard, accepted she must have been aware of the scale of the operation, but had been engaged by pressure and had no influence on the people above her. He said she did not profit through the operation and had only been funding her own habit and repaying a debt. Mr. James said she lost her accommodation but has new accommodation in Galston. He added that she has sorted herself out, having managed to kick the habit she had with drugs, and is working three jobs to help sustain herself through honest labour and not criminal endeavour. He said she is a carer and has also been helping to look after her mother following the death of her father, the aberration which led to the offending. Recorder Ruth Brander said both defendants would be aware of the devastating impact of Class A drugs, but Recorder Brander accepted there had been pressure on both of them to become involved to pay off Pollard's drugs debts. Dos Santos was given 20 months custody, suspended for 20 months, while Pollard received 22 months imprisonment, suspended for 2 years. Both defendants were given 15 days rehabilitation activity requirement and 200 hours unpaid work. In addition, both were made the subject of trail monitoring requirements, where their movements are electronically monitored, with Dos Santos given a 6-month order and Pollard 9 months.
And a man who dragged his ex-girlfriend down the stairs and strangled her during a 12-hour argument has been given a suspended prison sentence. Christopher Rolfe, age 34, has admitted to strangling his ex-partner during a fiery argument on January the 6th. Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court heard Rolfe had called police and demanded they come to the address. Lilica Pethera, prosecuting, said, "At 7:29 p.m, police received a 999 call from the defendant, who was extremely irate to the call handler. He demanded officers came to the address to see his ex-girlfriend. Officers attended the location and the defendant was confrontational and irate from the get-go. He said he dragged her down the stairs. She said she was hurt and the officer tried to calm both of them down. He grabbed her around the throat and he said he wanted to murder her. The ex-partner thought she was going to die." The court was told Rolfe had also thrown a glass of water over his ex-partner and he was arrested at the scene after more officers arrived. Kirsty Chaplin, mitigating, said, "He is incredibly remorseful. There was an argument which went on for hours. After 12 hours, my client's self-regulation for his ADHD failed and this happened. The client called the police that she wasn't leaving the address and said, 'I need help to remove her.' He resents what he did and is willing and motivated to work on his behaviour." Appearing at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court, he pleaded guilty to intentional strangulation and 2 counts of assault by beating. Anthony Smith, presiding magistrate, said, clearly these circumstances crossed the custody threshold. It was quite frightening for the victim. Rolf of St Andrew's Road in Galston was sentenced to 26 weeks in custody, suspended for 18 months. He was also ordered to pay £85 in prosecution costs and a £154 victim surcharge.
A man accused over reports two girls have been raped on a Norfolk beach is due to appear in court this month. Madeline Ilinka has been charged with one count of rape, one count of sexual assault and one offence of sexual assault by penetration. It was after two teenage girls reported they had been raped on Great Yarmouth's South Beach on May the 16th. The 34-year-old Romanian national of Suffolk Place, Great Yarmouth, is due to appear at Norwich Crown Court on July the 28th for a plea and trial preparation hearing. Police had previously said that one of the two suspects in the rape inquiry had fled Norfolk. A second man, also in his 30s, was arrested in Northamptonshire on May the 17th on suspicion of rape in connection with the same incident. He remains on police bail until August the 10th, while investigations continue. The force declined to specify the other suspect's nationality when asked.
An antisocial behaviour offender has been handed a four-month jail sentence after not turning up to court. Geoffrey Sherritt, aged 37, of no fixed address, was sentenced for repeatedly breaching an injunction that barred him from entering Hawkins Close in Great Yarmouth. The court order, imposed in October of last year, followed ongoing complaints from people about his behaviour. Great Yarmouth Borough Council's social landlord team gathered evidence and brought a new case against him. At a hearing at the Norwich County Court, which was held in Great Yarmouth, Recorder Gibbons found him in contempt of court and ordered a warrant for his arrest to be issued. Councillor Emma Flaxman-Taylor, portfolio holder for Housing, Health and Communities at Great Yarmouth Borough Council, said, "Our residents deserve neighbourhoods and homes that are safe and welcoming. Where there is antisocial behaviour affecting people's quality of life, we will always take action against those responsible. This sentence from the court sends out a clear message that the council will prosecute where appropriate and seek justice."
Welcome to another edition of Grapevine Extra. This week, Andrew and Alison take a look at the history of heat and its effect on what is fast becoming our brown and pleasant land.
Now, we're all enjoying, well, I hope we're enjoying this current heatwave, although it has cooled a little bit. Obviously, talk in the news is all of that. And many of us, of course, remember the heatwave of 1976 and the water shortages, etc., etc. But my research tells me there was another notable one, and a very disruptive one, over 100 years ago. The United Kingdom heatwave of 1911 was a particularly severe one and had associated drought. Records were set around the country for temperatures, and in England, the highest accepted temperature at the time was 36.7 degrees Celsius. In those days, it would have been recorded in Fahrenheit, of course, which was 98.1, believe it or not. And that was only broken 79 years later in the 1990 heatwave, when temperatures reached 37 degrees Celsius, 98.8 Fahrenheit. A temperature of 37.8 degrees C, which is 100 degrees Fahrenheit, was recorded at Greenwich in what is known as a glacier stand, and this was regarded as a record. But further data from the Stevenson screen in the same location showed the temperature to be around 96.6 degrees. Now, the current highest recorded temperature in the UK is at 40.3 Celsius, which translates to 104.5 in Fahrenheit. Sounds hotter in Fahrenheit, doesn't it? And that was measured on the 19th of July 2022 at the weather station at RAF Coningsby in Lincolnshire. There is some conjecture around this, though, because as the weather station is on an airbase, some say that the environmental influences are affected by taxiing jets. So this measure apparently can't be considered as absolutely pristine. But in 1911, the heatwave began around early July and ended 2.5 months later in mid-September. By the 17th of July, temperatures were, I'm going to stay in old money for this, temperatures were 81 degrees Fahrenheit. And by the 20th, there'd been no rain for 20 days, meaning a drought had officially begun. In the height of the heatwave at the end of July, temperatures were 91 degrees Fahrenheit in King's Lynn, which broke all previous records in that area. And the heatwave and drought continued into August, with temperatures up to 81 degrees on the 1st of August, continuing throughout that month in London. Even in September, the heatwave saw temperatures still up at 91 degrees. And the heatwave and drought only ended on the 11th, when average temperatures dropped by 36 degrees Fahrenheit, and the high pressure dominating the country receded, allowing rain to cover most of the country. The impacts of the heatwave, of course, extended all over the country, and they began to be felt around mid-July, around 3 weeks after the heatwave began. Because of the extreme heat, working patterns changed. For example, in Lancashire, work would begin at dawn, which is around 4:30 a.m, finished around midday to avoid the hottest part of the day in the quarrying industry and manufacturing, etc. And fatalities became common, and newspapers such as The Times ran deaths by heat columns as temperatures continued to rise. The heat also caused indirect deaths by melting the asphalt on roads and causing numerous accidents. By the beginning of August, even the health of country people was being adversely affected with stifling humid nights, meaning, of course, we're back in the earliest 20th century there, food spoiled very quickly without refrigeration, and also the sewerage, the infrastructure there was not very good, and sewerage spilled everywhere. Workers now started to go on strike, and in August, most notably in the Victoria and Albert docks, the entire workforce of 5,000 people walked out because of the intolerable heat, meaning the whole area came to a standstill. The drought then began to affect all parts of the country, and the effects were felt around mid-July when early harvests were taken in and fires began to break out along railway tracks, because of steam trains, of course, in and around Ascot and Newbury in that area. By the end of July, the heat and lack of rain had begun to affect agriculture. There was a shortage of grass for cattle as pastures had turned brown from drought. This forced farmers to raise the price of milk to compensate for the lack of production. On the 28th of July, trees and some rare plants had begun to wither and die with the lack of water in the soil, even in shaded areas around the country. And by August, wells, water pumps and water supplies had begun to run completely dry. This led to the stopping of activity in farming and pasture in Essex, and the sunshine in July 1911 broke all-time records for the UK across the south coast of England, with Eastbourne in Sussex and Hastings having a monthly total of 384 hours, which averaged 12.4 hours a day. Many other south coast spots, such as Bognor Regis, were not far behind. Much of the south coast outshone many Mediterranean locations, and Eastbourne was very close to the levels of sunshine expected in, now listen to this, Las Vegas in the Nevada desert in the US for July. Since the average July sunshine in Eastbourne is about 255 hours, the town had received about 50% more sunshine than usual. So this obviously brings up the global warming discussion again. This was going on over 100 years ago, and I guess with the lack of media coverage, people at the time didn't know quite so much about it. So let's hope ours breaks soon and gives us all a little bit of relief. Alison now is going to take us a few years further into the 20th century, I believe.
Yes. A short reflection on what Andrew's just been talking about. This July is proving to be one of the hottest on record so far. In fact, the summer of 2026 has been a record-breaking one to date. Listeners may know that yesterday, the 15th of July, was St Swithin's Day. Legend has it that whatever the weather may be on that date, exactly the same conditions will prevail for the next 40 days. Swithin was the Bishop of Winchester in the 800s, but all that is known of him is that his remains were transferred to Winchester Cathedral on the 15th of July 971, a day when it happened to be raining heavily. Since then, folklore has suggested that if it rains on that date, it will do so every day for the next 40 days. This year, it seems as if the opposite might apply, so we may continue to have hot, dry weather for some time to come. Moving closer to home and the current era, some significant anniversaries occur in July 2026. In Great Yarmouth, the boating lake was opened 100 years ago in July 1926, after 6 months of construction at a cost of £12,700. The Venetian waterways, originally known just as the waterways, followed 2 years later. The construction of both the lake and the waterways was a government-funded scheme to boost employment after the First World War. After the war, Great Yarmouth's fishing industry suffered, with the loss of the export of 80% of the annual herring catch to Germany and Russia, causing unemployment and hardship for many. During the first half of 1926, 127 local men were paid 1 shilling an hour, which is less than 0.4 pence today, to dig out and construct the boating lake. 12 hand-cranked paddle boats, each costing £11, were made in Galston to be available for hire during the summer season. The boating lake and the waterways have remained a favourite with tourists and visitors ever since, and as most of you will know, the area was renovated by volunteers in 2018. July 1926 also saw the merger of the Great Yarmouth and Galston branches of the RNLI, which became known as the Great Yarmouth and Galston Lifeboat Station. Great Yarmouth had its first lifeboat in 1802, but no records of this remain. In 1825, the Norfolk Association for Saving the Lives of Shipwrecked Mariners, or the NASLSM, stations its first lifeboat at Great Yarmouth, and the RNLI took over the station in 1857. In 1859, a new lifeboat house was built. The building still stands, with some alterations to its front, at the corner of Standard Road and Marine Parade. Galston had had a private lifeboat since 1802, but a new RNLI station was set up there in 1866. By 1919, the two Great Yarmouth lifeboat stations had been closed, and by 1924, the Galston station was operating only one lifeboat. It had had as many as four previously. So the decision was made to merge the stations in 1926. Some notable rescues include the rescue of a crew of 24, along with a black kitten, from a steamship wrecked on Scroby Sands in October 1922. The rescue of a Dutch oil tanker in 1927, and involvement in the Dunkirk evacuation in 1940. One more notable event was the general strike by the TUC in May 1926. In Great Yarmouth, railway and transport workers joined the strike in support of coal miners. This brought parts of the local economy, such as the docks and the power station, to a temporary standstill. However, there was no violent unrest in the town, and life returned to normal within a few days. It's interesting to wonder what will be remembered in 100 years about Great Yarmouth in 2026.
Well, that's it for this week. Grapevine is copyright 2026 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Next week, your newsreaders will be Desney and Margaret. So, we hope that you'll join us then for much more of your local news. But in the meantime, here's hoping that you stay safe and well and cool, and from all your friends at Grapevine, enjoy your week, and it's bye for now.